Americans have elected their first president with no prior political or military experience, and Donald Trump will be soon the 45th president of the United States. As our country and the world reacts to this news today, we thought we would talk about how this will affect not just transatlantic relations, but future elections upcoming in Europe, our economy here in the U.S. And I think the reaction of two European leaders was very telling as to how many people, especially those outside the United States, are feeling. UK Prime Minister Theresa May offered a boilerplate sentiment congratulating Donald Trump, adding that the US and the UK have a special relationship and that she looked forward to working with them. And I should add, I got another email this afternoon from the British Embassy talking about a very cordial call that they had earlier today. And German Chancellor Angela Merkel had simply this to say: "Germany and America are connected by values of democracy, freedom, and respect for the law and dignity of man, independent of origin, skin color, religion, gender, sexual orientation, or political views," she said, adding, "I offer the next president of the United States close cooperation on the basis of these values." So we know it's not just the U.S. establishment that's reeling from this, and half of the country, I should say, but also much of the world. So that's what we're going to talk about today. Is this our American Brexit? What does this mean, not just for American, but European and global economies? And what about all the political ramifications of this? We want to start with our panel here on stage, a group well-suited to discuss these immediate implications, what we know and what we don't know going forward, because I think that's an important part of this discussion as well. Our guests today are Valerie Wuchsel-Laxton, Head of Economic and Financial Affairs for the Delegation of the European Union to the United States in Washington; Kostas Kordiktakis, an Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign; and Shamira Gelbman, who's an Associate Professor of Political Science at Wabash College in Indiana. Thank you guys for being here. Shamira, can I start with you, with your immediate reaction? Did you expect Donald Trump to win the presidency?
I did not. So I study American politics and have been teaching a course on election polling this semester. And so I've been following polls fairly closely, and for the most part, this didn't seem to be coming. If you look at political science chatter today, there's a lot of, well, we were in the margin of error, just in the wrong direction. There's some talk like that. But I think if you had asked anyone the morning of Election Day, anyone who's been following the polls on the morning of Election Day, what's going to happen tonight, I don't think anyone would have said, well, Trump's going to win, and he's going to win all of these states. I was definitely surprised. There were early signs in the evening. The down-ballot races in Indiana, I think, were a signal that maybe I should have taken more seriously than I did early in the evening. But then it gradually became clearer and clearer. And it took a while, but then it became clear that there was no path for Clinton to win.
Valerie, I'm going to put you on the spot because you just came from Washington. So I'm curious what the Washington establishment, the foreign sort of the diplomats, the core of people who are working on foreign policy, what's the tone in Washington right now?
Well, you know, I left Washington last night, so
there you go. It's a good sign.
Very early days, and the little I picked up was indeed to echo the previous speaker, was this sense of surprise. I think everybody was looking at the polls, maybe very closely, maybe too closely, and we were quite surprised in the results, yet it was a very clear result in the end. And the American people have chosen their new president. And the immediate reaction is really to come in Washington, to go and see the people who are working closely with him and to understand exactly and specifically the details of the policies he'll be working on. And that's really our attitude to it. We have a very strong relationship with the U.S. being the EU, and it's very important to us. It's a strong and deep relationship which we are going to continue working on. So the immediate reaction is to go out there and meet our counterparts and the people who are working with the president-elect to work together on strengthening this relationship.
Mm-hmm. Kostas, Valerie said a clear result, but not if you look at the popular vote. Certainly a clear result according to Electoral College. And I know For my family in Europe, I've spent a lot of time explaining the Electoral College in the past, not just this year, but in previous years when this has happened. I wonder what you think the reaction has been in Europe, what you're seeing. I'm curious what you've heard from folks.
First of all, I'd like to say, in relation to the reaction of the experts, I think this has become part of the story, actually. The fact that the experts are surprised, that's part of the story of this election, so how they were taken by surprise by the result. Although, I have to say that for those of us who study European politics, although I wouldn't say that we saw this necessarily coming, in the back of our minds, we always had the Brexit vote, because that was another case of an election where experts thought that the Remain campaign would win, and then all of a sudden we got a very different result. And so I think I can speak for myself and people I know in Europe, political science professors that I had been in communication with during the campaign, who thought, well, okay, all the data show that Hillary Clinton is the favorite to win, but is this going to be another case of the Brexit vote? And I think for a lot of experts on Europe, this was not a completely unfathomable possibility.
So would you say this is our American Brexit?
I don't know what you mean by this question, because I think Brexit was, this referendum was about a very clear question about whether the United Kingdom would get out of the European Union or not. And I don't think that this is, there is a comparable question in this case. What I think is comparable is how the electorate reacts to a similar question. And I think the question in both cases, and so that's where I see a similarity there, is how much do they want their country to be engaged with other countries? And not just how much, but also in what way.
By that I mean a couple things about the establishment not recognizing it, about a popular sentiment and feelings of maybe anti-globalization, of maybe countries turning inward. Shamira, I wonder if you can just speak to the missteps in polling and how much you think that, both in the UK and here in the US, was a complete lack of recognition of how, both in the UK and the US, half the country was feeling.
Yeah, polling is always challenging, right? You're basically trying to grab a small piece of the population and generalize from that to a large, diverse country. And we rely still very much on techniques that were developed in the 20th century in a very different communications context, a different demographic context. And so I think pollsters for the last decade or so have been kind of coming to terms with the challenges of a population that doesn't answer the phone anymore, right? They kind of had to deal with cell phones, and they sort of figured that out, but didn't really account for the fact that people don't answer cell phones the way they used to answer landlines back in 1985, right? I think part of the problem is just the technology of public opinion polling hasn't quite caught up to the way people work, right? The way people interact with each other. And I think it's been a vicious cycle, with the public increasingly skeptical of polls, tired of polls. There's a lot of fatigue. People don't answer the phone when they know it's a pollster or find a way to hang up in the middle of the call. And the more the polls are wrong, the more people are likely to do that. And so I think there's going to be kind of a big moment of reckoning for pollsters after this year's Brexit vote and now the U.S. presidential election. There will be a little bit of, well, we were somewhat close, right? Some of that conversation. But I think also, what do we do next time, right? How do we approach polling, and at what point do we kind of hang it up in 2018, 2020?
Mm-hmm. Costas, I wonder how much you think this is a reflection of, I know you've done a lot of research on sort of new social groups, that we may be a new recognition of the way people are looking at engagement within not just their country, but the world and the global economy. How much do you think that this, what we think about, I mean, I think when we think about Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders both representing two different revolutions in a way, that are very anti-establishment, that are very different economic conversations than we've had in the past at least decade or so. Do you think that that's part of this conversation also, that we haven't had enough?
I think people's interests have changed, and what they're sensitive to has changed. And so so globalization is one of the reasons why people think differently, and they're willing to vote for different parties and different candidates than they used to in the past. So we tend to think of the electorate in this classic left-to-right dimension where you have working class on the left, the middle class in the middle, and then part of the middle class and the upper class on the right. And so we tend to think, let's say in the case of the United States, but also in most countries of the world, we think of, you know, parties of the left as having part of the middle class and the working class, parties of the right, part of the middle class and the upper class. And that's how we understand politics in the world. But I think what has been happening is because of globalization, we see part of the people who were voting for left-wing parties and part of the people who voted for right-wing parties, they now are voting together against globalization, and some of those traditional constituents of left-wing parties and right-wing parties, they're favoring globalization. So I think the new division in society is not between left and right as we understand it. It's between people who are pro-globalization and anti-globalization. And so I think what Donald Trump did, and I think some of the Brexit campaigners did that were successful, is that they were able to understand that the electorate has changed, that the divisions in society have changed, and so that it contributed to their success.
Mm-hmm. Kostas, you were talking about sort of the economic anti-globalization forces, but I also wonder how much we see, and I don't know if you would, and Shamir, I'd love to have you weigh in on this also, how much we see a reflection of European nationalism. And I'm thinking about even the congratulations that we saw to Donald Trump, obviously from France's far right, from Marine Le Pen. Certainly we saw close ties between Donald Trump and UKIP. I know if Nigel, even though I know it's even divisive how Nigel, is it Farage or Farage? I know, however, everyone's arguing about he pronounces his name. But I wonder how much you think that Donald Trump, in to a certain extent, do you think that is an actual tie? Do you think that exists?
I think there certainly is a nationalist or super patriotic strain among at least a segment of Trump supporters. I think one thing we picked up during the primary season was that the Trump vote is kind of a mixed bag, but I think there certainly is that strain. I think even the slogan Make America Great Again speaks well to it, and the fact that it resonated the way it did, I think suggests that there's certainly that strain in his base of support.
Well, for me, my take is slightly different. Mm-hmm. For me, nationalism is not the cause, it's the effect of something else. And the cause is globalization. I think people feel threatened, some segments of the population. They feel they've lost out to globalization. They think about their parents and grandparents who used to have stable careers in certain industries that do not exist anymore. They feel nobody is speaking up for them, so they feel threatened by globalization. And then on the other hand, there are people who have benefited from globalization because they have the kind of training, they know foreign languages, they have degrees that allow them to be mobile, to get, you know, good jobs in industries that are much more modern. And I think those people who are in the first category, the people who feel they have lost from globalization, they're the ones who turn to xenophobia and they turn to nationalism. I think it's a coping mechanism for people to think back to a time when things were better and they want to go back to that era. Now, we can talk about whether that's possible or not. That's why I think that the Trump voters are, as Shamir said, a mixed bag, is because you see different people who've lost to globalization for different reasons coming together. And I think Donald Trump did a very good job at understanding the concerns of those groups and expressing them during the campaign.
So when you say different ones, I wonder if anyone can weigh in here. When you say there are different reasons, I mean, certainly I have talked to and had a lot of people on my program saying, I lost a manufacturing job 20 years ago. I blame the Clintons for that. You know, that's kind of the biggest one that comes to mind, I think, here in Illinois. What other, when you say there's sort of different reasons for sort of different ways that people you think would have supported Trump, what do you mean by that?
It's not just workers. So we tend to think of this group of workers who did manual jobs. But also there are, let's say there are farmers, for example, right? That's a different category. So it could be a very successful farmer. Maybe not, that individual didn't travel very much, has not had a lot of contact with people from other countries. So for that person, seeing, for example, immigrants in his or her community, that may be threatening to them. They may think, oh, you know, these people are new. So that is not necessarily a person who is motivated by economic concerns, I don't have a job, but maybe their previous upbringing and cultural training has not prepared them to accept new people with new customs. So these are people who might find that, you know, a much more xenophobic or nationalistic message resonates with them. So I think there are people who have economic motivations, people who have cultural motivations, and they are all represented by certain candidates.
Can I just add to that? I think this is also part of the story where people feel a little bit that they are no longer in control of their lives and of the environment they are in.